Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, folks, to hear Senator George Brandeis, who makes his first appearance at the Sydney Institute. He's well known to you, so I'll introduce him briefly. He studied arts and law at the University of Queensland. He also got a BCL from Oxford. His practice as a barrister is written, but most importantly from our point of view, he's been a Senator for Queensland since the year 2000. He was Minister for Arts and Sport in 2007 in the Howard government, Shadow Attorney General since 2007, and Deputy Leader of the Opposition in the Senate since 2010, and currently Shadow Attorney General and Shadow Minister for the Arts in addition. And tonight, Senator Brandeis is going to address the Sydney Institute on the topic of the Freedom Wars. Senator Brandeis, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jared. Let me begin by acknowledging our hosts this evening, Clayton Utes. Thank you very much indeed for your hospitality in providing this venue for tonight's occasion. And of course, the work of the Sydney Institute, which has for a very long time now been one of the engine rooms of ideas in Australia. As Jared said, I've chosen as the topic of tonight's address the Freedom Wars. Thursday, the 21st of March, the last sitting day before Parliament rose for the Easter recess, will long be remembered as one of those days of frenzy and madness which, infrequently but memorably, punctuate the pages of our political history. It was, of course, the day of the famous leadership challenge that wasn't. We will long remember Simon Crean's stupendous press conference, as much as we remember the confused hours and bizarre outcome which it called forth. The political shenanigans of that day masked an event which was in its way even more consequential. The announcement earlier that morning by the Minister for Communications, Senator Stephen Conroy, that the government would not proceed with its attempt to create a statutory office of public interest media advocate, the most overt interference by an Australian government with the freedom of the press since Governor Darling unsuccessfully attempted to license newspapers in the colony of New South Wales in 1825. Just 24 hours earlier, the Attorney General, Mr. Mark Dreyfus, had announced that the government was also abandoning another of its ill-conceived assaults on political freedom, the bizarrely entitled Human Rights and Anti-Discrimination Bill, which famously, or perhaps I should say infamously, proposed to make actionable the expression of political opinions on the ground that they might be insulting or offensive to other citizens, and, for good measure, proposed to test that requirement by the subjective standard and with a reverse onus of proof. That same morning, as Mr. Dreyfus was announcing the government's backdown on the anti-discrimination bill, Mr. Crean gave a little noticed speech in the House of Representatives, although he did not know it at the time, his last parliamentary speech as arts minister, introducing the Australia Council bill. This bill, currently before the parliament, is the product of an extensive review of Australia's principal arts funding body, whose operations have hitherto been governed by a Whitlam era statute, the Australia Council Act of 1975. Although Mr. Crean told the House of Representatives that, quote, the core principles of the Council enshrined in the 1975 Act are retained by this bill, there is one core principle which has disappeared. Section 5 of the existing Act defines the functions of the Australia Council as being to formulate and carry out policies designed, inter alia, quote, to uphold and promote the right of persons to freedom in the practice of the arts. However, when one inspects the comparable clause of the new bill, one discovers that the protection of artistic freedom has mysteriously disappeared from among the Australia Council's core functions, a development not missed by members of the arts community themselves. And so, in the space of a remarkable 24 hours, two significant parliamentary victories for freedom of speech and one discreetly concealed setback. It was, of course, but a coincidence that all three events took place at much the same time. But that coincidence does serve to illustrate the argument I wish to make tonight, that this government is engaged in a multi-front war against the traditional liberal conception of freedom of speech, sometimes by overt acts, but just as commonly by fostering a climate of opinion in which the centrality of the right to freedom of speech as one of our society's core values is increasingly being questioned in a way which was unthinkable even a decade ago. This is not just an instance of the instinct of Labor politicians of a certain type to stop at nothing in bullying their opponents. I think Senator Stephen Conroy is a bully before he is a social engineer. But at least on the part of some, the former Attorney General, Nicola Roxon, comes to mind, and she is far from being the only one. It is a conscious, systematic attempt to change the culture so that freedom of speech and expression is degraded among our public values in place of other newly imagined rights whose very vagueness conceals an ideological agenda as illiberal as anything this country has seen in the political mainstream. The ideological character of that deliberate distortion of the rights debate cannot be better seen than in the fact that almost invariably it is commentators or observers who represent a liberal, in the classical, not the modern American sense of that word, or conservative point of view, who are silenced. Intolerance is back in vogue. Indeed, if you are a social engineer or left-wing activist of a particular hue, then intolerance of those whose thinking does not conform to your agenda is not a defect. It is an emblem of righteousness. It is not the spirit of Voltaire which informs the thinking of this Labor government and its ideological avatars. It is the spirit of Robespierre. Of course, I have never had a lot of confidence in Labor governments to defend freedom, although in decades past it was economic freedom rather than political freedom which was mostly in their sights. What is more disappointing, in fact alarming, is the pusillanimity and indifference of those for whom one would have expected the defence of freedom would be second nature. Let me give you three recent examples, three recent reports from the front, as it were, in the freedom wars. And let us start with journalists. Last Friday night in this very city, I attended an event which was grandly styled the 2013 Australian Press Freedom Dinner. Almost 500 journalists gathered to celebrate freedom of the press, or so I thought. Coming within weeks of the government's abandonment of its attempt to limit press freedom, I thought that there would be a lot to celebrate. And having played my own modest role in the freedom debates of the past year, I was expecting a companionable evening among fellow freedom lovers. How silly was I? A foretaste of the evening came from a pre-dinner conversation with David Marr, who, in full theatrical Couch of the Insiders style, upbraided my colleague Malcolm Turnbull and me that he hoped we weren't going to confuse press freedom with Andrew Bolt's shameful defamation of innocent people. As the evening got underway, the MC, Hugh Rimmington, made fleeting reference to the failure of the government's media regulation plan before warming to his real topic, journalists' shield laws. There isn't a more pressing issue for journalists in this country, intoned Mr. Rimmington. Now, given that this country had just escaped the first peacetime attempt at government control over the content of the media in almost two centuries, I must say that I felt a little more might have been made of that fact at a dinner ostensibly convened to celebrate the freedom of the press. But at least Mr. Rimmington hadn't actually praised press censorship. But then came, by video link, none other than Mr. Jonathan Holmes, who described the laws as having perhaps been, and I'm quoting him, I made a note of his words as he spoke, a missed opportunity to impose a modicum of responsibility on those who control the media in our country. Finally, Mr. Chris Warren, the head of the Journalists' Trade Union, made a spirited speech in which the topic was not touched upon at all. I certainly didn't feel that I had happened upon a nest of freedom fighters. Indeed, I had the rather unsettling sense that I had come to the wrong dinner. But I left with the very strong impression that if a fight for freedom of the press is to be fought in this country, it's not going to be fought by journalists, or at least not by those of their profession, who convened at the Bacchanal at Cockle Bay last Friday night. The second illustration of changing attitudes to freedom of speech comes from another of the institutions which traditionally prided themselves as being bastions of intellectual freedom, the universities. There is, sadly, so much evidence of the new culture of intolerance in at least some of Australia's universities that seldom does a week go by without a new instance of the erosion of intellectual freedom being reported. Let me give you one recent example. So far as I am aware, unpublicised, save for in the Quadrant online magazine. The field evidence comes from Mr. John Spear, who is a law student at the University of Melbourne and a member of the Melbourne University Liberal Club. He reports an incident, or series of incidents, which occurred during orientation week this year. In the University of Melbourne's orientation week in February of 2013, the MULC did as it has always done, writes Mr. Spear, and set about promoting itself to attract new members. Orientation Week has traditionally been our biggest recruitment drive of the year, in addition to manning our allocated booth at the Clubs and Societies Expo. We all set up a number of stalls around the Parkville campus. These stalls are generally decorated with various Liberal Party core flutes, publications, stickers and various other promotional giveaways. This year, one of the core flutes, kindly donated to us, originated from the 2001 federal election campaign. This particular core flute pictured then Prime Minister John Howard and his quote, "We will decide who comes to this country and the circumstances in which they come." On one particular day of O Week, the club displayed this core flute proudly at our stall, a reminder of one of the Howard government's most successful policies. Within minutes of displaying this core flute, members of the MULC were approached by university academics who believed it to be racist and disgusting. In addition to this, they insisted we had no right whatsoever to display it at our stall. Senior members of the club explained that whilst they were free to hold those opinions, we were perfectly within our rights to voice our own beliefs and display a piece of official election material. With the debate ending rather quickly, our stall was soon approached by the University of Melbourne security staff, who stated that they had received complaints about the core flute. They then ordered the MULC booth off the campus. After it was explained that all present were both MULC members and students of the university, thus having a right to be present on university grounds, the security staff then attempted to remove the core flute from the grounds of the university. Now, let us remember, that's the end of Mr. Spear's quote. Now, let us remember what the offending comment was. It was a remark made by a recent Prime Minister of Australia while serving as Prime Minister during the course of an election campaign, briefly encapsulating in a sentence one of his government's key policies. It was, in fact, and we have this from no less an authority than Mr. David Marr, the very policy on which he went on to win the election. Indeed, so strongly approved of was that policy by the Australian people that Mr. Howard not only won the election, but won it with an increased majority. As you know, it is a rarity in Australian politics for an established incumbent government to increase its majority. One of the few other times when this happened was in 1966, when Mr. Harold Holt took to the people his policy of strong support for the American intervention in Vietnam, all the way with LBJ. The academics who sought to politically censor Mr. Speer and his friends were, of course, the lineal successors of those who sought, in the 1960s, to prevent Australia having a peaceful, civil debate about the wisdom of Australian participation in the Vietnam War. As Mr. Speer rightly concludes, whilst this incident may seem trivial, it typifies the difficulties and harassment expressed by conservative and libertarian student organisations. The mentality of the left in the practice of freedom of speech equating to, I don't want to see it, therefore it can't be displayed, is arrogant and abusive. We might also call it absurd if not for the chilling glimpse of the totalitarian mindset determined to crimp and control all conversation and thought on campus. And remember, it was not left students who complained about our display, but academics, who should be dedicated to the free and unfettered discussion and dissection of ideas. Whilst the fight for freedom of expression and speech may be at a temporary ceasefire in Canberra, it continues to escalate in the tertiary institutions of this nation. Now, I should say that after a preview of this speech was published in the Australian newspaper this morning, I was contacted by the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Melbourne, Professor Glyn Davis, who wrote to me to express concern to reaffirm his university's commitment, which I do not doubt, to intellectual freedom, and to point out to me that no record of this incident was recorded in the logs of the Melbourne University security staff. My third instance of the assault upon freedom of speech is the agency which the Parliament created for the very purpose of defending it, the Human Rights Commission. Now, let us remember that when the Commonwealth Human Rights Commission was established in 1986, its statutory charter made it responsible for promoting an understanding and acceptance of human rights in Australia. Human rights were defined to mean the rights and freedoms recognised in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, as well as a number of other international human rights instruments. The Covenant is in fact incorporated as Schedule 2 to the Act. It contains, of course, a variety of different human rights, which it is important to remember are not ranked in according to priority. Article 19 deals with intellectual freedom and freedom of expression. It provides, everyone shall have the right to hold opinions. Everyone shall have the right to freedom of expression. And this right shall include freedom to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas of all kinds, regardless of frontiers, either orally, in writing or in print, in the form of art, or through any other media of his choice. Section 3 of Article 19 recognises qualifications to those rights, but only in relation to such matters as the protection of reputation, national security, public order, and what is described as public health or morals. During the Senate estimates last February, I asked the new president of the Human Rights Commission, Professor Gillian Triggs, a distinguished international lawyer with a human rights specialisation, what the commission had done during the press freedom debate which had raged for most of the previous year to advance the cause of freedom of the press and freedom of speech more generally. In other words, what it had done to discharge its statutory obligation to promote the acceptance within the Australian community of Article 19 of the Covenant. The answer was not encouraging. Indeed, apart from providing a platform to Mr. James Spiegelman to deliver a human rights lecture last year, which he had used to attack the anti-discrimination bill, Professor Triggs was unable to offer any example at all. I should also point out that at the time the invitation was issued, the Commission had no idea on what topic Mr. Spiegelman would speak. Professor Triggs went on to say this, let me quote it from the Hansard. Because the public debate has focused, as you say, stimulated by the Bolt case and the Human Rights and Anti-Discrimination Bill and the Honourable Mr. Spiegelman's speech, we have had an emphasis on the proper limitations of freedom of speech. I think it would be fair to say that we have been very much in action over the last few months on this question, but we have not been emphasising the right to freedom of speech. We have been emphasising the way in which the balance in relation to it is established, either under the current legislation or under the bill that is now proposed for the future. Now, just reflect for a moment on that statement. At a time when, stimulated by the Bolt case, provoked by the Finkelstein report, freedom of speech and freedom of the press have been the subject of public discussion to an unprecedented degree, the immediate response of the government's own human rights watchdog was to emphasise its limits. Of course, there are proper limits to freedom of speech, as there are to all other rights. However, I doubt that the Human Rights Commission would approach its anti-discrimination function so negatively by concentrating on the limitations of the law rather than giving them their fullest scope. It was, by the way, during the course of that exchange that I made my suggestion, since taken up by some conservative commentators like Janet Albrechtson and Chris Kenny, that since there is no officer dedicated to upholding the various freedoms which the Covenant protects, we should appoint some freedom commissioners. Now, I hasten to reassure you that the last thing I want to do is bloat the size of the human rights bureaucracy. My point was really a rhetorical one. Nevertheless, there are, I should remind you, no fewer than 7 human rights commissioners, some of whom are here tonight, I'm pleased to say. Welcome, the President, along with 5 who deal specifically with anti-discrimination issues. The Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner, the Age Discrimination Commissioner, the Disability Discrimination Commissioner, the Race Discrimination Commissioner, and the Sex Discrimination Commissioner. And 1, the Children's Commissioner, who has essentially a protective role which duplicates the various child protection functions of the states and territories. Given that the Covenant establishes, as I said before, no priority between egalitarian and libertarian rights, in other words, the rights protected by Article 19 are just as important as all the others, even a single commissioner dedicated to protecting those rights might seem to be reasonable to redress the balance. I'm sorry to say that the picture I have painted is a pretty bleak one. While Labor governments may come and go, how did we get to a point in Australia? There are so many journalists who will not fight for freedom of the press, so many academics who will not uphold intellectual freedom on university campuses, and when even the Commonwealth's own human rights agency is more interested in the limits of freedom than in its avowal. Who defends freedom of speech in Australia today? Is it really to be left to a few conservative commentators like Andrew Bolt and Janet Albrechtson, a couple of think tanks like the Sydney Institute and the Institute of Public Affairs, and the Liberal Party? What is most striking about the freedom debates today is not just the fact that the attacks upon freedom have come from the radical left, but the almost complete absence of those of the moderate left in freedom's defence. For left liberals and progressives, freedom of speech is not the passionate cause it once was. Respect, whatever that may mean, matters more. And increasingly, that means controlling what people may say. Historically, parties of the democratic left championed liberty, at least civil, if not economic liberty, as well as equality. They preached the fairer distribution of mankind's resources, but they also preached emancipation. Progressives of the left shared many of the values of liberalism, and they adopted much of its language. The emancipation of women from patriarchal social structures was called women's liberation. Following the Wolfenden Report in England, the repeal of laws which prohibited homosexual conduct, and in the decades afterwards the ready acceptance of gay people into the community, came to be called gay liberation. The relaxation of censorship was a liberal cause supported by the left, based upon the belief that adults should be free to make their own decisions about what they read and saw. In the 1960s and 1970s, progressive public opinion was all about the extension of freedom. Within the Liberal Party and similar centre-right parties elsewhere, this created tensions between the liberalising elements and those conservatives who continued to value social cohesion over personal freedom. Today, it is the self-styled progressives of the left who want to ban things. In particular, they want to eliminate the expression of opinions which they find offensive. Sometimes this takes the form of overt prohibitions, of which Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act is an egregious example. As witnessed in the Bolt case, freedom of speech and its corollary freedom of the press are for these people values of less importance than respect for certain favoured groups who are identified in their minds by their alleged victimhood. Thus, paradoxically, victimhood becomes the basis of a new kind of privilege. Showing respect to their special status is a more important value than the freedom to call that status into question. And so, as in the Bolt case, by making certain classes of citizens immune from criticism, or certain issues immune from debate, the boundaries of legitimate public discussion are restricted. But more often, the censorship is more subtle. The key technique here is to control the language, because the left have learnt well the lesson George Orwell taught us, that if you want to control what people think, then control what people may say. It is no coincidence, by the way, that one of the great prophets of the New Left, the American writer Noam Chomsky, began his career as a professor of linguistics, whose pathbreaking work was in the study of the relationship between language and the cognitive structures of the brain. As Winston Smith discovered, there is no difference, distance at all, between speech crime and thought crime. In the path of such attempts to control social behaviour by controlling the language stands freedom of speech. It is for that reason, I believe, that freedom of speech has not just ceased to be a cause of the left, but has come to be seen by many of the left as an obstacle. And so, in the course of perhaps the last quarter century, the era of political correctness, the democratic left in Western nations has abandoned its liberalising instincts, or at least subordinated them, to a kind of secular moralising, which seeks to refashion society not by arguing its case, but by silencing those who differ. In parallel with that development, we have seen the emergence of a new moral self-righteousness. The advocacy of the left's favourite causes, be it climate change, gay marriage, the treatment of asylum seekers, Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act, ceases to be an argument in the traditional sense of that word. Rather, it becomes a series of declarations of civic virtue, in which the alternative view is not just disputed, but treated as morally flawed. Think of any random Q&A audience and you'll see what I mean. And so the moralising new secular left has come to resemble the moralising old religious right. united by their shared assumption that since they know best how people should live, their unique insight gives them the privilege of dictating what people may do, what they may say, even what they may think. This might seem to be a paradox, but it isn't really. All arguments for censorship have an essential commonality, that I may make choices for you, but you may not make choices for me. And this gives us a further paradox. For as the left abandoned its commitment to the most important of all the civil liberties, freedom of speech, it began to walk away from its commitment to equality as well. The idea that there is a certain section of society to whom has been vouchsafed an appreciation of moral truth on controversial social and political questions, which is inaccessible to the common run of people, is a profoundly inegalitarian one. It leads ineluctably to the emergence of a new self-selecting caste which considers itself to be above the rough and tumble of the democratic fray, which is defined by the fact that all ideas and opinions are entitled equally to a hearing. There is no doubt that the current Labor government and its Greens allies have encouraged the developments of which I have spoken. Minds that thought it was a good idea to outlaw the expression of offensive or insulting political opinions in the name of equality, thought it was a good idea to interfere with press freedom in the name of fairness. Minds that thought it was a good idea to remove freedom of artistic expression as a core principle of Australia's cultural policy are minds for whom freedom of speech is no longer a fundamentally important value. That mindset reflects a wider and more concerning movement in the attitudes and strategies of parties of the left during the course of the last quarter century, which not merely condones, but defends the narrowing of political discourse in the service of other ideological ends. It is a profoundly dangerous development, and we have seen it reach its culmination during the time of the Gillard government. But at least the debates about freedom of speech and freedom of the press, which we have seen in the last couple of years, have been a sharp reminder to the Liberal Party of its historic mission. Because in those wars, there has been only one party which has been consistently on the side of freedom. Thank you.
Many thanks to Senator Brandeis, SC, for a stimulating address to the Institute tonight. So we'll come to questions and discussion in a second. First, once again, thanks to Clayton Yutz for the use of this fine facility. Now, I'll ask a question. You can come up and position yourself here, and we'll be away. As the Shadow Attorney General, you've got to be a bit careful what you might say, although you weren't all that careful tonight. because if the Coalition wins the election, you'll be the Attorney General. And you've spoken tonight about the attitude of journalists, the attitude of academics, the attitude of human rights administrators. But you haven't mentioned the attitude of judges, as I recall. Now, as you just go back to your point, I mean, Mr. Finkelstein, a retired judge, was very keen to clamp down on press freedoms or media freedoms in his report, which the government eventually jumped. And of course, the judge in the Bolt case in the federal court started to speak about not merely what people wrote, but the tone in which they wrote them. So it's the old thing, it doesn't matter much what you say, it's what's between the lines or what people think you might have meant, even though you didn't quite say it. So you've now got this clamp down on human rights by judges who once upon a time were the embodiment of people who upheld human rights. So you can't change the legal system, but how do you see the judiciary in this?
Well, Jared, I gave, as it were, three cameos from journalists, some academics, and some human rights administrators. I think the two examples you give are very different. The Finkelstein report, about which I gave a speech last year at the Samuel Griffith Society, is, I think, a profoundly disturbing document, because if you read, there's a chapter two, about the philosophical rationales for freedom of the press. Mr. Finkelstein essentially dismisses as obsolete the 19th century classical liberal view of the contestability of ideas in a free marketplace of ideas. And he says, this is the phrase he uses, the 20th century moved more closely to collectivist political values, and that was the new intellectual climate. Now, I don't think the collectivist values of the new intellectual climate of the 20th century have a lot to be proud of, frankly. So I think the entire thesis of the Finkelstein report, challenging the liberal notion of the contestability of ideas, was profoundly wrong. That reflects one man's views. It reflects a particular social philosophy, which I think is profoundly wrong. In relation to Justice Bromberg's disposition of the Bolt case, I don't criticise it because I think he got the law right. I think the problem is not with his judgment. I think it's with the statute that he was interpreting. So, and he was the first judge seized of this issue about what Section 18C means and what, or fully seized of the issue of what constraints it imposes on political discussion. By the way, when the then minister in the Keating government introduced Section 18C into the Racial Discrimination Act, Senator Nick Baucus, it was, he actually said in his speech in the Senate, you can read it, this provision is designed to prohibit speech crime. He was, I think, oblivious to the Orwellian resonances of his rhetoric, but that's what he said. So, as to judges generally, I am myself a product of the legal system, of the bar. My first job was as a judge's associate. I think Australia is extremely well served by its judges. I don't think we have the problems of ideological distortion of legal principles by judicial activism in the way that the Americans have. I'm not saying either, by the way, in a Panglossian way, that there aren't some exceptions to that. But I quite deliberately do not extend my critique to judges who seek to apply the law as Parliament has written it to the best of their abilities.
Thanks. Lindsay.
The Liberal Party has said that it's going to repeal Section 18C, but I think Tony Abbott, like you, have said that you're going to bring in a replacement section. Where are you going to draw the line? And I use the example of the cases brought by Jeremy Jones on behalf of the Jewish community against Frederick Tobin, where they've been able to use that section. I don't know whether they've achieved anything beyond successful cases, but they've used it successfully against it.
Well, you're right when you say that we've said that that we will repeal that section. Replace it with something which does some of the work that Section 18C does, because see, part of the problem with Section 18C is it's very badly drafted. It prohibits four categories of conduct which offends, insults, humiliates or intimidates. My concern is about freedom of ideas, intellectual freedom, freedom of opinion and the right to express it. I don't claim there is a right to intimidate people. There isn't. There's not a right to intimidate people. There's not a right to harass people. The word harassment, by the way, isn't used in Section 18C. So the answer to your question, where do I draw the line? I draw the line on the other side of conduct which will have a chilling effect on intellectual freedom or the right to express unpopular opinions, but on this side of intimidation and harassment. They're quite different concepts.
Milton.
Senator Brandis, I wanted to talk about another area of freedom in the law, and that's the freedom to contract, something that governments of all political persuasions are generally held to be inviolate, subject to the common law principle of unconscionability. Sorry about that. The opposition has now undertaken to extend the unfair contracts law in the Australian consumer law to business-to-business contracts, which is quite a substantial assault on the freedom to contract and the certainty of contracts. I guess that will probably fall to you to implement in governments. How do you view that in terms of freedom of law?
It may actually fall to my colleague, Mr. Bruce Bilson, the Shadow Minister for Small Business. My background is as a commercial lawyer, as a commercial barrister. I am sceptical of every invasion of freedom of contract. There are certain justifications to create exceptions. Equity courts have known that for centuries. However, my disposition is to need to be persuaded that a further invasion of freedom of contract is required in a particular case. Obviously, the greater the degree of inequality between the parties, the more ready one would be to say, well, this contract is reviewable because of the lack of equality of bargaining power. Conversely, when it comes to business contracts and parties negotiating at arm's length, fully informed of their rights and capable of looking after themselves, then I think a much higher threshold of satisfaction would be required to make such transactions reviewable.
Next question, yeah.
What you've described tonight, what's truly frightening about what you've described tonight, is that the failure to defend freedom of speech by the academy and also by the press is widespread right across the Western world. In relation to your problems with the Human Rights Commission, for example, Canada has had the same sort of problems, and do you think that in Australia we're going to go down the same road as Canada has gone in the failure to defend freedom of speech in general rather than the particularisation of culture that some lobby groups choose?
Well, I don't know, but I hope not. Let me make this clear. I think we should have a Human Rights Commission. I think we should have an apparatus for the advancement and protection of human rights. My concern is that human rights are a variety of different rights, some of them inconsistent with each other. When you read Isaiah Berlin, this is his great thesis, that there is no holistic, integrated theory of rights, that certain rights are intrinsically inconsistent with others. What I want is an acknowledgement that all the rights recognised by the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the various other important human rights instruments matter. What I want to see is an acceptance that what I described in the speech as the libertarian rights, the freedom-based rights, are just as important and in some cases more important than what I described as the egalitarian rights. That doesn't happen.
Question here.
Yes. And then, yeah. Some years ago in Victoria, a rather batty group, I can't think of the name, like Save the Fire or something, had a symposium on the Koran, and as a result of which they were fined $40,000 in the courts, as far as I know, and that's never been altered. Now, I don't know exactly what they said about the Koran, but it seems to me terribly important that you can say anything you like about other religions, otherwise you would never have the reformation if you can do that sort of thing. I just don't know how...
Okay, so it's a question about the Save the Fire case.
Well, look, I think that we should not have
in a secular society, because we are a secular society which is ought to be respectful of all religions and respectful of people who have no religious faith, I don't think we should have a law of blasphemy. There used to be, as you know. That's a matter for the churches. And therefore, it troubles me that there are some who would say, well, if you criticise a particular religion's doctrines or theology or even liturgy, then you are offending a secular law, that you could be offending a secular law, because you're not. And there shouldn't be such a secular law in a secular society.
There's a question here.
Senator, do you not think there's something absolutely fundamental that's more important than any individual law? And that's the thing that Nicola Robson brought into play that last year, reversal of onus of proof. That seems to me incredibly dangerous.
Well, you're right. And I whether it's more dangerous than attacks on freedom of speech, I'm not sure that I would agree with that. But what troubles me a great deal is, I'm sure it happens in the States, but I know it happens in the Commonwealth. It is now almost routine to see bills written where there is a proof requirement and there is a reverse onus, either on the entire issue or on certain critical issues in the offence. We looked the other day in a Senate committee at the amendments to the ASADA bill, the Australian Sports Anti-Doping Agency. There are routine. But routinely there were all these reverse onuses of proof put into that so that sports people would have to prove that they weren't taking drugs. It's a very topical issue at the moment. Now, there are certain circumstances where there is a justification for reversing an onus of proof. But I think those circumstances are rare. And why, for example, an onus of proof should lie upon a sports person to prove they weren't taking a drug is quite beyond me. So one promise the Liberal Party took to the 2010 election, which we will take to the 2013 election, I promise you, is I will, if we were to be elected, ask the Australian Law Reform Commission to conduct a review of all the Commonwealth statute law to identify the reverse onus provisions and review them so that the reverse onus of proof is only retained where it is absolutely essential that it be retained.
Alan?
You alluded to one example of restriction of freedom of speech on campus, and we all know there are many those instances springing up of the increasingly illiberal intellectual climate on campus. As the primary funder of universities, does the Commonwealth have a role in ensuring that that trend is reversed?
It certainly does, and the Howard government did that in one very important way in relation to voluntary student unionism. I mean, that is has become, of course, the totemic issue for students. And the Howard government, as you know, Alan, having worked for the Howard government, made university funding required of universities as a condition of funding arrangements, that this noxious practice that press-ganged unwilling students into joining associations they didn't want to belong to, a condition of university funding.
So,
I'm done.
And you want... No, Lindsay? Yeah.
I might stir you a bit. Which do you think might happen first? What's called gay marriage or the Republic?
I don't know the answer to that question. And I think, again, they're very different issues with very different arguments for and against. I have been very, very closely following the Republic debate because I am a former patron of the Australians for Constitutional Monarchy in my home state, Queensland. And I have never accepted the inevitabilist argument.
I have never accepted that it is inevitable that Australia will one day be a republic. As to gay marriage, I don't know, I make no prediction.
We were in the constitutional group at the Ideas Summit, and I think it went 99-1, and you were the one.
Well, I was, Jared, but can I tell...
And I was with David Marr and Philip Adams and Robert Mann.
You were. But can I tell the audience the context? Where the convener of this governance stream was Maxine McHugh, and with, I thought, a certain world-weary arrogance, she did say, surely there's no one who would believe in the constitutional monarchy. At which point I said, I do.
I remember that.
And it wasn't 99-1, it was 98-1 with one abstention. The abstention being Sir William Dean, who was perhaps conflicted or perhaps just cowardly.
Down the back, yeah.
Senator, as attorney, will you change the practice of legislation by press release with no legislation for 12 months or 18 months or even more to actually have bills prepared before introduced?
Yes, I would. And in fact, I gave a paper about that very topic to the Rule of Law Conference in Brisbane about 12 months ago. And I'd also, by the way, and it's a similar sort of issue, seek to change the practice of Henry VIII clauses.
Could you just explain Henry VIII clauses?
Henry VIII clauses basically delegate to the minister...
Oh, that might be about marriage or something.
No. To delegate to the minister the capacity to repeal or amend what the Parliament has passed.
Okay. Frank.
A question about thought leadership. If you look back to the last century, there are very, very famous authors. You know, you mentioned George Orwell, we can think of people like Arthur Koestler and many others, Ayn Rand, who were widely read and responded to the horrors of the age. How do you think that thought leadership will appeal to the masses, if you like, in the internet age? And who is carrying it forward and who can carry it forward? Or do we have to wait for more horrors before we get such a popular response and a correction?
Well, I think that's one of those questions that you can only know in retrospect. I mean, let me remind you that when George Orwell found it very, very difficult to get published. Books that we today regard as canonical were barely known and became acknowledged with the passage of some years. I think the first print run of it was either 1984 or Animal Farm was tiny, because there was a kind of intellectual conspiracy almost of the left, who dominated the publishing industry in Britain and the literary reviews, not to give him any credence and any airtime, as it were. We see the same phenomenon in different fora in Australia and today. So I think who will emerge as the thought leaders is something that can't necessarily be known at the time. But I do think that the centre-right of politics, people who have a predisposition towards freedom rather than social control, will be seen to reflect the spirit of the age.
Yes.
I just want to put a Pollyanna point question to you. I understand everything about Finkelstein and I agree with much of it. What was interesting was, and the same thing happened in Britain, that with all the brouhaha about the scandal in Britain, which then led to Finkelstein and the idea that we had to control the media in their dreadful ways, the whole process went through to the Parliament. And what was fascinating is that it was the voice of the people in the Parliament that watered the whole thing back to something more common sense. Don't you have a faith that our system can deal with these things and that some of the problem is that the other side hasn't been vocal enough in standing up to the kind of imprint of long-time lefties in the universities and had more of a stake there?
Well, I think the voice of liberal reason, and again I use the word liberal in the classical, not the modern American morally relativistic sense, the voice of liberal reason has been on the defensive for years and is now beginning to assert itself, and it must. because whether it's in culture, whether it's in the academy, whether it's in the media, whether it's in all of the intellectually influential areas of society, we have eroded or abraded our deep commitment to freedom. It shocked me. It really did. I'm not being hyperbolic when I say this. It shocked me that we got so as close as we did to regulating the media as much as we could, Conroy wanted to do. It shocked me that we got so close to passing this anti-discrimination bill, which would have prohibited people from expressing political opinions because they were thought to be disrespectful of other people. The best place to have this argument is in the free, turbulent, untidy, magnificent, glorious process of a free parliamentary democracy in which everybody is entitled to a hearing. Bad ideas are exposed by the light of day as being bad ideas. Good ideas rise to the fore. Fads and fashions are seen for what they are. Enduring values are seen for what they are. But nobody is told you're not allowed to say that.
Yeah, and that's what happened.
There's a question down there. We've got to be brief. Yep.
What do you think of the objectivity of the ABC or lack thereof?
Well, I'm inclined to think that, like most institutions, there does develop what the former chairman of the ABC recently described as groupthink. I wouldn't overstate the point, though. I think that the ABC does a wonderful job in a lot of the things it does. But as somebody who has a lot to do with ABC public affairs, I think it would be refreshing to see provocative people from the right on the ABC as well as provocative people from the left. What we don't want everybody saying the same thing. We want the greatest variety of viewpoints being heard in the public space. And if ever there was something that qualified as the public space, it ought to be the public broadcaster.
So let's say you become Attorney General in September. What would your priorities be there, very briefly, in that portfolio? And assuming you'd also be Minister for the Arts, and this is a bit out of left field, what would your priorities there be?
Well, my attitudes would be as I've expressed in the speech tonight. My particular priority, one of the first things I would want to do, as I said in answer to that gentleman's question as Attorney General, is to review the Commonwealth law so that all of the invasive powers, the invasive regulatory powers, the reversals of the onus of proof, which shouldn't be there, all those affronts to traditional rights and liberties that have lazily been put there over the years and so that now it's almost routine, we're taking a good look at. That would be that one of the first things I want to do as Attorney General. And I don't take an absolutist position. I'm a practical person. I accept that there are, in some cases, on a case-by-case basis, justifications for creating exceptions to the traditional rights and liberties. But they have to be exceptions.
Many thanks. Take a seat.
Thank you.
Brief. I think that George Brandeis, he quoted from George Orwell quite a bit. I think he's been influenced by Orwell, because what Orwell wrote about, as you know, was the importance of clarity of view. And Senator Brandeis is very unequivocal and very clear, and there's no doubt whatsoever about his meanings, which I find very welcome. I think this will make the speech tonight a memorable speech and a long-lasting speech, because it's pretty clear about what he's on about. And for a shadow minister who may come into government within 4 months, that's very impressive. So we've had a lively speech tonight, I think also an important speech tonight, for which I'd say many thanks, and we'll have you back sometime in the future. Well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.